I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. Colleagues, there's some people that have to get out, so I'm going to be mixing around on the agenda. Right now, we will be hearing 1567 just from two people, and then we'll close it but come back to it, and then we'll open 1506, do that one, and then go... go in that order. Okay, with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1567. Representative Hunt and Senator Dingfield, please come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for having a public hearing on Senate Bill 1567 today. I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder, represent Senate District 23, the Northeast and Southeast Portland, and I'm also here with Representative Dave Hunt, who is a co-sponsor on this bill. I think I might wait until it quiets
down. Can we shut the door to the hallway?
Your committee is just about as busy and boisterous as my committee is. So this is a very important bill to an organization that both of us are very involved with, which is the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I've served as a member of that task force for many years. And you're all familiar with hunger still being a top priority, or fighting hunger, in Oregon. For most of us, eating three meals a day is something we take for granted. We try our best to make sure those meals are balanced as much as possible. But for many Oregonians, the ability to purchase enough food, let alone nutritious food, is simply beyond their reach. This daily struggle to eat nutritious food has only worsened with the current economic recession, a recession that's affected nearly everyone, including older Oregonians. Most seniors planned for their later years by saving money and relying on Social Security and retirement funds to support them. However, today much of that money has already been used, and many seniors are now in the unforgiving position of trying to decide whether to pay their rent or purchase food. Through my work with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I also serve on the Hollywood Senior Center Board, I've learned that frequently fast food or prepackaged food is less expensive than fruits and vegetables, and we've all seen this, I think, in our communities. That means seniors who are hungry regularly skip meals or eat cheaper, less nutritious food. Yet proper nutrition is just as important for seniors as it is for everyone else, and a lack of sufficient nutrition in seniors is often associated with falls, which can lead to injuries requiring costly hospital or nursing care. For these seniors who find it beyond their financial means to purchase nutritious food, there's something we can do to help. We can increase our support of the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program. This program provides vouchers to low-income seniors, which they can then use to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables at farmers' markets and roadside stands. I consider this program a double win for Oregon, since we can support seniors and our local farmers at the same time. I've seen this program be very successful in the farmers' markets in my district, and I've heard in the districts actually all over the state. However, current funding levels for the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program only provides vouchers for about half of all eligible Oregon seniors. So what Senate Bill 1567 does is it calls for a modest increase in funding so that we can serve more seniors in need. It's estimated that an additional $350,000 investment through this small amount, we can provide vouchers to about another 10,000 low-income Oregonians. That's 10,000 more seniors who will have a better chance of staying active and healthy. In closing, I know we are discussing a bill asking for an increase in funds during a time of tight budgets and immense fiscal challenges. However, it is partly because of these severe economic conditions that more seniors are lacking the ability to purchase nutritious foods. At the task force, we've talked about the fact that healthy seniors are part of a healthy community, and with Senate Bill 1567, we can help seniors in need stay healthy and eat a balanced diet. I ask that you join me in supporting Oregon seniors through the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program. And with that, I will hand it over to my colleague from the House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Dave Hunt, State Rep from Clackamas County. I would really just add two points in support of Senate Bill 1567. One, it's rare that you are able to get, I think, the bang for the buck in terms of the dollars that are spent here. The fact that it really is this under this program, it really is a free market system where you're giving vouchers to people that are then required to spend them on the free market and to the benefit of especially small Oregon farmers. As we think about economic recovery right now, even as folks are getting new jobs or are getting more new hours, the universe of folks that are being served here, these low-income seniors, are not going to benefit even from economic recovery, because by definition, they're not the ones who are going to be going back to work hauling gravel. They're not the ones who are going to be going back to work as a nurse. These are folks who are going to continue to be low-income seniors even as the economy gets better. And so giving them a tool that they can then use to further stimulate a part of Oregon's economy, which is important but also struggling, agriculture is very important. The second and final point is thinking about what are we doing this session to benefit seniors. The House is sending over a bill for your consideration. We just passed it yesterday, related to fixing the senior property tax deferral program. That will be a good, important one that for a sector of, I think, about 1,700 seniors will help them stay in their homes. This is really the only other one I can think of that is out there that is an opportunity to say to a group of needy seniors, Here is a hand that will help help benefit you, help benefit Oregon's economy, and stabilize a lot of these folks who don't have a lot of other options. So I encourage your support. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple points of disagreement. First, Representative Hunt, I'm not aware of any economic recovery at this point in time. And to Senator Dingfelter, I would suggest when you say that fast food is cheaper during the season, you can come to my farm market and get 3 ears of corn for a dollar, which would beat anything McDonald's can offer.
I would prefer your corn over McDonald's anytime. And I will say McDonald's is my former employer, so I'm sure I'm going to get in trouble for that one.
But on a more serious note, and by the way, I do support this program. We take the cards at our stand, and I was really happy when they made the cards a more reasonable size so they fit in the check stands. But we've also been told by the co-chairs of Ways and Means that the budget deal is done, and there will be no more adjustments. And I know you're aware of that. So, you know, and I talked to some folks yesterday. We're in a position where we can send this bill to Ways and Means and feel like we've done something really good. Well, no, I know, it's just public hearing now.
Right.
But and I fully support the program, but I guess I kind of get a little frustrated with us sometimes when we send bills to Ways and Means and make them out to be the bad guys, and which I don't really like to do. So it's just with the full knowledge that supposedly there's no room for adjustment in the budget is my only concern.
And I would just make 2 points in response to that, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz. I mean, you've been here more sessions than I have, but in the 5 sessions I've been here, I've never seen a budget deal that really is the final budget deal until the final gavel drops, and I assume that will be through this session as well. Secondly, all the budget deal was actually based on an assumption that the forecast this week was going to fall between 50 and 100 million. It fell 35 million. Right there, they actually built it on a more conservative assumption, wisely, than the situation in which we find ourselves. So if we were talking about a $50 million program here, I would agree with you completely. The fact that this is a $350,000 ask.
Okay. I would also suggest that although it wasn't down as much as some thought, the trend is still down, and we still have a whole lot of this biennium left. But anyway, that's...
Well, and Madam Chair, if I may just add, Senator Cruz, I appreciate your support of the program, and that is part of the is to just make sure that we continue to advocate for this important program and remind folks that the need exists and will continue to exist. And I am grateful for the fact that we are able to help the agricultural community as well, because through these types of programs, it's, as we said, it's a win-win, and we want to make sure that they continue to advocate for these types of programs and keep it in front of the legislature as an important way to solve both the gap for seniors and also continue to support agricultural enterprises throughout the state.
Yeah. Madam Chair, just one more point, just so nobody's confused. We sell a lot more than just corn.
I know. I ran out of the jam you gave me, and I would like some more.
Maybe after session, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much for hearing us today.
All right. With that, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on 1567, yes, and open a work session on Senate Bill 1506 because we have some people that have to leave right away. So the people that need to leave, let's
Elizabeth
see.
Brimley, Chris Bonhoff.
Chris Bonhoff. I think you're the one that has to leave.
Right.
And then Robin Henderson and...
And I think that's short drive.
That's it.
And I don't know who... It's got passed to me. Someone wants to testify. I don't know who that is.
Okay. And that, we also got another note that someone else wants to testify on 1506. But you'll need to let the committee administrator know. Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson, and members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonhoff, Executive Director for the State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thank you for indulging my time request that I have to rush back to Portland for a family commitment. I wanted to come in and continue to express our support for Senate Bill 1506. There have been some changes to it that Dr. Henderson can go in more detail about. It doesn't do everything we would like it to do. Some of the language of creating a pilot is now has been taken out of the bill. But I think it takes us in an important direction in the state in that it creates a mental health clinical advisory group under the Central Oregon Health Council. The group is basically the same composition with some changes, a very broad stakeholder-based group. And it really tackles some key pieces from NAMI's perspective that are sorely missing in the state, which is kind of that education component, the treatment algorithms that not only involve the utilization of mental health medications, but all the other therapies and supports, psychotherapies that are available out in the community. And tries to pull those together in one place. This is not unlike a similar body that was created in the state of Indiana recently when they considered the issue of utilization of mental health medications. So it is a composition that nationally NAMI is very enthusiastic about. And we're very eager to work with the Health Council in particular because of any entity in the state, they've taken integration of mental health and physical health farther along than frankly any other entity in the state. And I think this is a natural extension of that since they've been working on that integration, bringing in the medication piece as the final piece of the puzzle to full integration. We're also very supportive because this will have application not only statewide, but it will have application informing the rest of this conversation on transformation as we transition into the world of CCOs. What does that integration piece look like, in particular, not only with mental health medications, but again, you're going to have players in the system who are more accustomed to working on the physical health side, who are unaware of the many beneficial therapies and support services that are currently available in the mental health, the public mental health system that is in a carve-out system. So we see this as a very crucial piece to tie some of these pieces together and continue to inform that conversation as that whole health transformation process evolves. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Robin first.
Good afternoon, Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Dr. Robin Henderson. I am the Acting Executive Director of the Central Oregon Health Council. And I want to thank you again for the opportunity to talk about this bill. As Chris alluded to, we had to pull the pilot project out of this bill due to costs. We learned the other morning that in order for the state to give us those dollars, they would also have to give us the administrative fees along with it. And that created the fiscal that would have been untenable in this short session at this time. That said, it's still good policy. And the creation of the work group to study the data in a considered manner allows us to keep the conversation moving forward. I met with the Health Council yesterday and presented the changes to the bill. While they're disappointed about the loss of the pilot, they do feel and endorse working with NAMI Oregon on a work group over the next year to be able to come back to you in March and say, here's what we could have done. here's what this might look like. Here are some fiscal projections of have we done some of these interventions, and also have the opportunity to say, gee, you know, some of these interventions might not have been so good, might not work really well, might not be something that we're looking at. We haven't seen the data yet, so we don't exactly know what it is that we're looking at. We look forward to being able to see it. This sets a deadline for when we'll get it, and we really hope that we can use this work group process in a very helpful manner to inform not only our own transformation efforts in Central Oregon, but those transformation efforts statewide, and continue the conversation next year. Because in order to be a fully functioning CCO, you've got to be able to have it all in your capitation and be able to see it. So we really hope that we can move that forward next session.
Okay, so you're saying that there will be amendments to this bill?
There is an amendment that this is the red line and you have it. It has not come back from LC yet, I don't believe.
Okay, and so we're on such a short time frame. We will need to have the amendment, and then we'll have to get permission to send it out if we don't have the fiscal statement.
It went to Sandy yesterday, and so it's with LC now?
It is.
Okay.
Senator Cruz.
I'm just curious why you need legislation to create a work group. You can do that on your own.
We recognize that, and part of the reason we wanted the legislation was to keep the conversation moving forward so that we would then have the mandate to report back to you. And we felt that that was important so that it didn't get lost in the conversation. We wanted to keep it moving forward. We also wanted to make sure that we had, you know, a deadline for when the data would be available.
Senator Cruz, if I may, it is very important for us because, frankly, in the conversations about transformation as it pertains to the integration of mental health, that piece of the conversation has been missing. You have at the table in those conversations the entities that manage the benefits of that, but you don't have the practitioners in there. You don't have anyone looking at that piece of, if I take this and I integrate in this, what should that actually look like? That has always been a piece missing in our state, period, in that we've on the mental health side, we knew certain things worked, but we never had the effort to put those pieces together into type of voluntary algorithms that is being encouraged by this legislation. And so for an organization like ours, it's very important for us is a statement that says the correct way to do this, best practices, this is important for this state. And so this gives us, for in our view, a stamp of approval saying, you know, yes, go this direction, do these things, come back to us and tell us how this could be done.
Madam Chair, I suggested in Douglas County, all those people are at the table and it didn't take legislation to make it happen.
They're at the table in Douglas County, and I would say the rest of the state is not at the table, nor would probably what's happening in Douglas County going to inform what happens in the rest of the state. And I say that with due respect, but I don't think so. Having watched MHOs and MCOs and different counties interact not far beyond their borders, you will not have the adoption of best practices if we leave it up to each region to do that.
We're going through change. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 1506? All right. With that, I thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1506 and carry it over until Monday, whenever Monday is. Monday.
The 13th.
The 13th. Day before Valentine's Day.
Day after Sunday.
Okay. All right. With that, we only had two more people to speak on Senate Bill 1567, the informational. So I'll reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 1567, and Robin Johnson, Cassandra Griffin, and Phil Wong. I guess three people. Sorry.
Yeah, he just.
Phil. Sandra. And Robin Johnson? Oh, you got that. Okay. Great. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. I have laryngitis.
It's better today.
It's much better. I met with several of you over the week, and some of you didn't hear it, some of you did. So thanks for your indulgence on this, Matt. It'd be better if I was jazz singing. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Robin Johnson. I'm the Community Advocacy Coordinator for the Oregon Hunger Task Force and Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. Thank you for agreeing to take time in the agenda today to hear Senate Bill 1567, which addresses the important issues of state funding for senior farm direct nutrition programs. I'm here today to testify in support of this proposal. As you know, senior farm direct nutrition programs allow seniors who are at least 60 years of age participating in SNAP or Medicaid and make at or below 135% of poverty, which is about $14,000 a year, just so you know, to receive $32 a farmer's market season in vouchers to spend at farmer's markets and farm stands across the state. Last year, the program served about 30,000 seniors and brought in just over $800,000 federal dollars with very minimal state investment to Oregon farmers in the form of fresh fruits and vegetables on the tables of Oregon seniors. Pardon me. Unfortunately, we weren't able to serve all the seniors who are eligible and asked for this help. About 6,000 eligible seniors were sent, I'm sorry, postcards. I appreciate that in the discussion with each of you this week that there was unanimous recognition of the great importance of this program for both seniors and the farmers they shop with, and a shared frustration with the limitations of our current budget environment. Additionally, I believe this committee clearly recognizes that seniors require greater consideration towards their health and medical needs that can become compromised when there is not enough food to eat. Though I understand that this committee won't be sending the bill onto Ways and Means today, however, I'll ask you for this. Understanding that hunger continues to persist as a problem for working families, children, and particularly seniors, the Oregon Hunger Task Force respectfully requests that you ask your colleagues on Ways and Means to continue to prioritize food and to join you in being vocal champions for feeding Oregon seniors and supporting Oregon agriculture. And with that, I'll thank you for your time. And if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to. Thanks for your indulgence with my raspy voice.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Cassandra Griffin. I'm with Upstream Public Health, a statewide organization working to improve the health of Oregonians. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1567, which is good for seniors and good for farmers. Upstream Public Health worked in 2011 on House Bill 2800, which supported farm-to-school initiatives in Oregon. We enthusiastically support this bill as another way to get more local produce into the refrigerators and stomachs of more Oregonians, in this case seniors. It offers the same opportunity to improve the physical health of a target population while improving the economic health of Oregon farmers. We support the existing Farm Direct Nutrition Program, and we support this proposal to expand it to reach more people. As Senator Dingfeld emphasized, this is a double win for both the seniors and the farmers. Regarding the economic situation, in the Oregonian on Wednesday, commenting on the revised budget forecast, Senate President Courtney said this: "Revenue is down a little, but it will fit within the co-chair's budget proposal. That means we can move forward with a budget rebalance that will keep our schools open and criminals behind bars. It means we can take care of our seniors and provide services for people with disabilities and our children." So as Representative Hunt said, there's not a lot going on this session to improve services for seniors, but I encourage you to look hard at this proposal and see if you can get it through and take this opportunity to help them get more fresh fruits and vegetables into their stomachs. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Oregon Food Bank. I'll try to keep my comments brief, and thank you again for holding a hearing on this bill. And I'm here to explain why this bill is important for Oregon Food Bank. Well, it actually serves two areas which Oregon Food Bank strives to address. One is hungry seniors, and you have before you our latest fact sheet, which looks like this. We do this survey every year to give the public and especially legislators like yourselves a sense of who we're serving. And if you open it up, you can see the ages of the people that we serve. And the one thing I like to point out, and it's on the front page of it, and it just sort of points to why we are very supportive of this bill, is I think, you know, it's very obvious that we have a high need for hunger. Well, we have high hunger in Oregon, but what's the story that's not always told is what's happening on the food supply side, the food that food banks distribute. And unfortunately, I'm here to share with you that food banks across Oregon, and I'm sure the U.S. as well, are facing challenges with keeping like their warehouses full so that they can get the food out to food pantries in your communities all across the state. And just a quick, you know, anecdote, a few of us were down and food for Lane County, and as you know, Lane County, the timber county, got hit hard, and they normally like to keep 8 weeks of, you know, supply of food in their warehouse, and they're down to 4 weeks. And as I traveled through the state in the fall, I met with a lot of food pantries, and a lot of the shelves were bare. And so this points to why this bill is important. And the second area I wanted to emphasize, and that is Oregon Food Bank is very supportive of Oregon farmers. One of the things that we do actively is that we work closely with farmers to try to essentially acquire produce that they're unable to sell. And typically the way we do that is when they are unable to afford to, you know, harvest the produce, we are willing to pay for the labor to pick the, you know, the produce and the packet so that we can take that produce and put it in the food bank system. And this is essentially, you know, produce that that they're not able to sell in the market. And just a little connection to here in Salem, a few representatives of the Oregon Food Bank actually got a chance to visit with Senator Thompson's pear orchards, and from that visit he was able to facilitate Oregon Food Bank working with a lot of the pear growers down there, and just from that one visit we were able to extract 78,000 pounds worth of pears, and these are mostly storm damaged pears, which is not marketable but still very edible. So it kind of, so it brings us back to why are we supportive of this. This bill supports people who are hungry, and second, it supports Oregon farmers. So we hope that, obviously, you know, that you will take this message back to, you know, like your colleagues on Ways and Means, and ask them to take a strong look at what they can do to address hunger in the state during the February legislative session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think it is. There's more people getting emergency food boxes in Oregon since the recession than ever before. I happened to go to a fundraiser for SnowCap in my area, and there were hundreds of people there giving their personal money at the auction for various gifts. We raised quite a bit of money. So we need to go every angle we can, and we'll see what happens in Ways and Means. Thank you. Yes,
Senator Chair, and in my business, we donate a lot of food as well. But I want to point out in this picture that about half of that broccoli should have picked three days before it was.
Thank you very, very much for your testimony and bringing the bill forward.
I will tell you about the tomatoes that we get from California.
I know about California tomatoes. Buy Oregon tomatoes.
Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1567 and open a public hearing on 1509. Madam Committee Administrator, bring us up to date on this one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1509, we had a public hearing on it on Wednesday, and there was, who we heard from were the Board of Massage Therapists and the dental hygienists and George from the Dental Association, for amendments that they proposed. We had the -6s and the -7s. And things have evolved since then, and I have not kept up with it, so we may need to hear from them.
Okay. I sent the massage therapist home because this is got a little more complicated than we thought, and we will be dealing with that in the 2013 session. We definitely are eliminating sections 1 through 18 in that bill totally, so we're not going to deal with sections 1 through 18. We do have a couple of amendments proposed by the dental hygienists and the dental association, so I'd like George and Paul Cosgrove to come forward. And it was interesting to hear. I talked with one dentist, several dental hygienists, and one person from the Oregon Rural Health Group who had gone to a meeting at the dental board, George, or the dentalist?
The Board of Dentistry this morning.
The Board of Dentistry this morning. So we've got a moving target here, and we're not quite sure what we're going to come up with. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, speaking in support of the Dash A amendments.
Eight.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I meant eight, even though I said A. I apologize.
Okay.
I was briefly before you the other day, and I would just like to step back and give you a bit of history. Some would have said that this may be a change in policy, and that's what I'd like to lay out for the benefit of the committee. Several years ago, a couple of very entrepreneurial and caring dental hygienists asked the Board of Dentistry, under its general authority to allow them to practice in underserved areas, to allow them to practice in rural eastern Lane County, one up the McKenzie River Valley, one in Oak Ridge. And as the board was considering that request, it looked at two sets of data. Those are the data of who is defined as, what areas in the state are defined as health, dental health manpower shortage areas. It's a federal criteria. It's applied by the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division, and they designate these areas around the state, both for dental and for medical. And the second criteria the board looked at the request of the applicants was, where in there are there areas in the state where if you were a dentist, you would be able to get a tax credit under our rural tax credit program? The board approved those two people. They served. And then I think I mentioned briefly when I was here before, we asked to have that issue, instead of being a sort of unwritten policy, formalized into rules, and came up with a problem, a legal interpretation from the board's attorney that turned out to cause a sort of road jam. The difference between the Dash 8s and the other versions of the solution to this is one of them just simply replaces, puts back into statute the word locations, which is what was eliminated last session as a matter of a grammatical correction without any intent to make any change in substance. The other one puts back the word locations and also then puts in the two criteria that the board has previously applied in looking at these applications. And the rationale for that is we think that hygienists who are trying to do these work in rural areas need to know upfront in an easy, accessible way what are the criteria and whether the area that they're likely to set up their practice qualifies or doesn't qualify. What the board did today, we had filed a petition to create a rule. What the board did today, and I wasn't there, but I've talked to three people who were, is they referred our petition to its rules committee, but with the expectation that it might be moot because, in fact, you might be settling this issue as a matter of legislation. So I think they may be, at least in part, waiting on this committee for action. So we would encourage you, if you would, please, to adopt the Dash 8s and proceed to clarify this issue once and for all. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, so the Dash 8s, as I read it, the only change that concerns dental hygienists in this section is on page 7, and it says residents of areas that are federally designated as health professional shortage areas for dental care, or areas in which dental providers would be eligible for the tax credit described in ORS 315.613.
Correct.
So it's been brought to my attention that the metro area, Portland, would be considered a shortage area for dental care, and this would mean that expanded practice dental hygienists could establish practices there. and I need to have a response from you.
Madam Chair, happy to do so. Health manpower shortage areas for dental or medical are established either by geography or by population. And by that, I mean by different characteristics. Most of the state is designated as health manpower shortage area for medical and dental for migrant workers, for example. And most of the state is designated as such for low-income people. Multnomah County is only designated as such for low-income people. That didn't used to be the case. When I worked at Multnomah County Health Department, we actually had a portion of North Northeast designated as a geographic area, as a shortage area. But at the moment, Multnomah County is only designated as a shortage area for low-income people, which is a federal definition. My recollection is it's 200% of poverty is the definition that means low-income under the federal rules, but I'd have to check that to be certain.
So this wouldn't allow independent practices to be set up in the metro area?
It would if they were restricted to low-income people or any one of the other people that you have already designated in statute that these people can see, which is elderly people who are homebound, institutionalized people either in correctional or mental health or facilities for the aged, school children and their siblings up to the age of 18, people in hospitals, people in medical offices, people in nurse practitioner offices, all of those are already currently designated as locations wherever they are in the state. It's a real mixture of things we've done over the years with this. We basically have designated almost everyone and every place as a proper place of practice for these folks independently, except for sort of a private office in an area where there aren't very many poor people and we're all sort of middle-class and middle-aged. And that's the only
So I've heard from one dentist, I think the other committees can address that, who's in favor of this. But then I think I heard from Senator Morse that there were dentists that called him today that were definitely not in favor of this. So, Senator Morse?
We need to have clarification.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'm sure there are dentists that are not in favor of this. I'm quite certain of that. I don't know what the Board of Dentistry will do with the rules, if anything, at this point. There are dental hygienists who favor this. This seems to be often where we are on these issues. My suggestion is the Board of Dentistry has already designated these two criteria as the way to judge whether people should be allowed to practice independently. It usually mostly applies in rural areas, although you're correct, Senator Moss Anderson, for low-income people or for migrants, it may be also applying in urban areas. And that all we're doing here is putting in statute the criteria the Board of Dentistry has already applied in response to applications it's received to date. Now, I can assure you that many of the criteria that you've already put in statute were controversial at the time they were put in statute, and most of them were opposed by some dentists at that time. So I can't say that this is not without opposition. I recognize that.
Okay, so I had a conversation with George, and before you address that, George, we were talking about that, and they just met this morning, and we may really want to have Patrick Brock come up maybe Monday. But would you address just this issue first before we go to your section?
Sure. George O'Coolidge on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. In terms of, we support sort of the Dash 10 Amendment, which essentially, which I think is everything that we've agreed to except for that additional language. And as I understand, the Board of Dentistry also voted to adopt the support the Dash 7 Amendment today, which just adds the word locations back. I think there is a little bit of disagreement in terms of what, you know, sort of would be covered by this. Our understanding, and we've had some folks this morning at the Board of Dentistry, that this does get away from the access to care issue that we've all sort of worked together and does start to get to sort of sole independent practice for hygienists. I mean, one of the criteria that they look at is fluoride. And what are some of the communities that are fluoridated? Only 74% or 74% of the state is not fluoridated. I think Paul already mentioned some Multnomah County. I think as we continue looking through the criteria, where does how wide open does, you know, do we throw the door, I guess, on sort of this policy? I think our also intention is we, you know, we supported the adding back the location. Certainly the other piece, I think we were on the same page. We got this amendment sort of last night. We look at it as a fundamental policy change. that we're still kind of vetting and talking about. You know, that's our disagreement to the adding in that additional language.
Okay. I just very briefly, I don't think it's accurate, and I don't mean to contradict my friend here, but I don't think it's accurate that the board voted to adopt or support any of these amendments at its meeting today. It was a discussion without a vote on any of these amendments. They may have people on the board who prefer one or another, but I'm quite certain there wasn't a vote. The only other thing I'd mention is these are criteria that have been long established. When I worked at Multnomah County, we designated that part of North-Northeast. That was in the mid-70s. These have been criteria that have been used for years to designate whether an area is a shortage area. The reason fluoridation is one of those criteria is in places where there isn't fluoridation, there's a need for more dentists and dental hygienists because of the greater degree of caries. So it is one of the factors that is used in the designation criteria, but they have been around for many, many years. The other one, which is a criteria you folks chose when you set up the rural tax credit program for practitioners, and that is if you're in a frontier county or a town less than 5,000 that is more than 25 miles for full-time dental care, that is an area in which a dentist would, if moved into practice, would be able to get a tax credit. What we're saying is in those same areas, a dental hygienist ought to be able to practice independently because we've determined that they are shortage areas. They would not get a tax credit because they're not eligible for the tax credit, but that's a good set of criteria to use about where there's a shortage is the ones that you have already used and the federal government has used for years.
Okay. Yes, Senator Morse.
I'd like to ask for an amendment. That the legislature shall hereafter have no responsibility for scope of practice issues.
Well, but you know, this isn't a scope of practice.
It really
isn't. It's where they can practice.
It's a very funny issue. As I said, and I was a little bit facetious, and I really didn't mean to, we have decided these people can perform dental hygiene in an office with a dentist, or when the dentist isn't there. That's always been true. We've also decided they can perform it elsewhere. They don't perform any different procedures. They just do it elsewhere. And we have, over the years, defined that they can do it elsewhere without a dentist supervising them almost everywhere, except for, as I said, their own private practices in an area where there isn't a shortage of other dental providers, i.e. the commercial market. And I think that's the rub. It really isn't scope of practice. It's sort of a push and tug between two professions in a different way, an economic way, rather than a health indication way.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I amend my request for an amendment?
Okay.
We do not deal with division of markets.
I understand.
Okay, so on this piece, I would like to have a statement from the board, and if Patrick can't come, at least a statement on where they are at with the dash 10s, which we don't even have in front of us
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we do have the 10s?
Yeah.
Okay, the 10s. which would just put the word location back plus yours, mm-hmm. or the dash 8s, which clarifies in more detail rather than in having it in rules. So it would be, I know the board was going to wait to see what we did, but I think you can see from some of the members, they really wish that the board would take care of this without without putting up barriers for our dental hygienists to practice within their scope of practice. So,
Madam Chair, my final comment would be, we thought this was settled a year and a half ago when the two applications were filed and approved. So all we would like to do is get back to where we thought we were a year and a half ago for both these two folks and for others who were similarly situated. So whatever way we can get there, we'd be happy to do so. Thank you very much.
I mean, in my last statement, Madam Chair, would be the same thing. We think that the word locations was inadvertently deleted. We'd like to see that restored so we can go back to the way things were, just without adding additional.
Okay.
Thank you.
We hear that, but now wait. Now we go back to the first part.
Oh.
By volunteers, okay? And George, what I have heard in particular on page 6 on the 8s. Um, I think it's page 6, line 7. Dental hygienist license and another... dental hygienist licensed in another state while practicing dental hygiene without compensation at the invitation of a dentist licensed under ORS Chapter 679 or a dental hygienist licensed under, you know, ORS 680, et cetera. The concern is that if that dentist can invite dental hygienists to volunteer, but if dental hygienists are having clinics or and want volunteers, they are not able to invite dentists. And so they would like the language so that it's reciprocal. Mercy Mission, it's the dentists that are organizing that, and they bring everybody in. But if a dental hygienist is organizing a volunteer clinic, they would like to have that. And I was just wondering where the board would be on a issue like that.
Sure. Madam Chair, I think we could probably accomplish, you know, the goal by maybe stating something that less so much in the invitation that a dentist or a dental hygienist in good standing with their home state board can apply to the Oregon Board of Dentistry to do charitable work for a minimum time of, you know, 5-10 days, and that way it's not so much the invitation who's inviting who, but really, you know, what we want to do is we just want to allow that hygienists and dentists who are out of state who can come into Oregon to work at the Mom Project or the Mission of Mercy Project or other charitable events, that they have the ability to do so.
Right.
So I would support it, but I was just going to throw out a different way of stating.
Well, I think the term that was given to me would just have dental licensees, the term dental licensees, rather than stating dental hygienists or dental. And I was just wondering if we could do an amendment, have it ready. I want to make sure there's no controversy to that piece.
I don't see a problem with that, Senator.
And George and I agree that a little bit more flexibility in this would be appropriate. We support the notion, and the suggestion is perfectly fine.
Any other comments on this bill?
It'd be nice to have it resolved on that side of the dais.
I agree. I agree. But, you know, I think things are better than they were. It just is like pulling teeth, but...
That was just bad.
All right. With that, I close the. did I have a work session or public hearing?
Public hearing
on Senate Bill 1509, and I want to move this, carry this over to this February 13th, Monday, for work session. Yeah, not public hearing. Thank you. Now I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1570. And colleagues, I told Senator Winters that we would be moving this bill, but with an amendment, and she said she was fine with amendment, and the amendment, would you describe the bill? So I always forget to have you do that.
That's okay. I have a lot of testimony. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1570 requires the medical assistance coverage of prescriptions drugs that are immunosuppressant drugs or drugs for treatment of seizures, cancers, HIV, or AIDS. This declares an emergency effective on passage. You should have in your packet a -3 amendment dated February 9th, 2012. It has a breakout of the language to where it specifies that the original prescription was written prior to July 28, 2009, or that the request is for a refill of a prescription for, and it outlines the drugs, the treatment of seizures, cancers, cancer, HIV, or AIDS, or an immunosuppressant, and it also has a sunset date of June 30, 2016. And we've gotten a lot of written testimony in support of the bill.
And I believe I've gotten that to you. There's nobody who has signed up for the public hearing, and I do have some written testimony from Senator Winters.
I think that since we don't have anyone for public testimony, I would like to read her testimony.
Sure.
Okay. It says, thank you. This is from Senator Winters. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you one of my priorities, Senate Bill 1570. It would restore the critical protections that were formerly in place for those suffering from cancer, HIV, AIDS, organ transplantation, and seizures. When the Medicaid preferred list, drug list, was legislatively established in 2001, these drugs were part of the legislative carve-out. To this day, protects patient access to mental health medications. In 2009, Senator Winters led the session-long negotiations to authorize prior authorizations of certain Medicaid prescriptions subject to the final word of the prescribing practitioner. As a result of those negotiations, we retained the existing protection for mental health medications and for refills of the classes that are subject of Senate Bill 1570. Basically, Senate Bill 1570 restores the critical assurance of open access for these classes of drugs, protecting not just refills, but the initial prescription as well. While the Oregon Health Authority has not yet taken specific action to restrict access to these classes, I am deeply concerned that any expansion of the PDL does not impact the care of those suffering from these conditions. I am aware that discussions are taking place regarding the PDL expansion and even repeal of the protections for those with mental illnesses, and I am committed to ensuring the Oregon's poorest citizens receive the care and treatment as prescribed by their medical practitioner. As with mental health medications, access to the broad array of approved medications is critical to the care of these complex disease states. Finally, since these classes of medications are not currently restricted, I expect no fiscal implications. In fact, restricting patient access to the medications in the future is more likely to result in negative fiscal consequences than is this proposal. Relapse, adherence, and resistance issues, multiple physician visits, and negative societal consequences should be our primary concern. So with these changes, please join me in extending the legislative refill protection to these classes in general. And what I think, because we're going through transformation, and we know that CCOs may view this issue differently down the road, that is why we have put a sunset, 4 years. In 4 years, we will look at this again, just to see how things are progressing. All right? Is there any discussion?
Why only prescriptions written before 09?
I don't know. Can
someone call?
Yeah, and tweet.
Murray.
Murray.
Whose amendment is this?
Senator Winters.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ann Murray with Bristol-Myers Squibb. The amendment that you have before you is actually just a creative drafting to restore current law 4 years from now. So it's actually to repeal the sunset. When the sunset actually takes effect, it actually restores current law as it stands today. So the amendment you have in your hands is actually what's in statute right now. And it will become effective on June 30th, 2016. So this is the current ORS right now, but on the last page, it indicates that this language will become effective again on June 30th, 16. And the current language that you point out there, that's what's in statute right now. And that was because when the carve-out first went into place, they were grandfathering folks who actually were already on the prescriptions.
They started to do it that way now.
Okay.
Okay.
It's
confusing.
Okay.
Okay.
Put it back there.
All right. Is there any other testimony on this bill? Okay. I will close the public hearing. Do we have the fiscal?
No.
We don't have fiscal.
But you can adopt the amendment. If you
okay. Okay, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1570.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment into Senate Bill 1570.
Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendments into Senate Bill 1570. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1570 and carry it over until Monday, February 13th. Okay. And with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1562. Madam Administrator.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1562 requires the Oregon Health Authority, Department of Human Services, and Public Employees Benefit Board to develop goals, benchmarks, and plans to address diabetes, diabetes care, and complications from diabetes. It requires a biannual report to the Legislative Assembly on data, programs, outcome, and proposed next steps. And here's our folks.
All right, Tom Boyer and Nikki Trusiev and Elise Brown.
Good afternoon, Chair Mons Anderson, Nikki Terziev, here on behalf of Novo Nordisk. Members of the committee, thanks for seeing us one more time on this topic. I'm submitting, and then I'll introduce my colleague, Tom Boyer from Novo Nordisk, here today to talk with us a little bit more. But I'm submitting, just for the record and written language, the written testimony from our informational hearing in January. You'll also see kind of a draft roadmap of amendments that we had previously requested, and I did say to our good friends of the Department of Health, of Human Services, that I would put on the record so that as we move forward for conversations in the future, that we would be striking them from the bill, that they would not be implicated in the bill. Also, you'll have in front of you then some of the same materials, the American Diabetes Association's press release indicating their support for the Diabetes Action Plan, a legis brief from NCSL talking about this being a good idea, and then some stats specific to Oregon. And we also have some additional statistics for the Pacific Northwest if anyone is interested in a little bit of evening reading. And with that, I'll introduce my colleague, Tom Blair.
Chair Manas Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here again. I just want to commend the committee for its strong leadership on this issue. We clearly have some issues brewing here when it comes to diabetes, the cost, the impact that the disease is having on the state, and understanding that there's limited time this year. I certainly look forward to working with the committee and everyone else involved over the coming year and the days ahead. I will be here to talk about diabetes with you all until my last breath, if need be. I look forward to the opportunity to work with everyone. But just to briefly put this in perspective, the reach and impact on the financial side of diabetes over the last 4 or 5 years has just grown dramatically in the state. Today, the impact of the condition on the state amounts to about $2.8 billion. Half of that is inpatient hospital costs. This bill and the subsequent amendments have been supported by Council of State Governments, a wide cross-section of groups in other states. It's been enacted in Kentucky and Texas, and data is ultimately being generated. The goal of the bill is simply to get agencies to share in a report format that we can understand collectively what's going on in the fight against diabetes, and ultimately it's data that's been collected for approximately the last 15, 16, 17 years. And the goal is to provide the agency with as much flexibility as possible in providing information and details related to the scope and impact of the disease and their efforts. It really allows them to generate the information that they think is most appropriate for the legislature in making decisions on how best to fight this condition, because that information is absent today. I challenge anybody to find something that is more expensive from a cost impact than this disease to the programs. It's very difficult from a chronic disease perspective to find something that is going to have this dramatic of an impact over the years to come, and I think it requires some special attention. That said, whatever the time frame is, like I said, I'm happy to be here to help and lend my background and expertise to help the committee move forward over the days and years ahead. And thank you so much for your time.
Great. Elise.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown, representing American Diabetes Association, and we are here also to support Senate Bill 1562. I think you're just receiving ADA's formal testimony, so I'm not going to read that, but just wanted to be here to show our physical support for the bill. American Diabetes applauds Novo's efforts and vision in creating this legislation. And as Mr. Boyer mentioned, and in your materials, the statistics are startling, and so are the costs that go along with that. Diabetes is now affecting 800,000 Oregonians. So the need for these kinds of bills and partnerships in Oregon are critical. So again, just here to be here to support the bill and their efforts, and we look forward to working with Novo and all the stakeholders as during the legislative interim.
Thank you. I do have some questions. As you know, I made the decision not to move the bill. I felt there would be a fiscal and there would be new reporting requirements for the Oregon Health Authority. And so I would like to know why you have language to include at-risk populations, because that would include me. I'm a little overweight. You know, it's...
Sure. The reason that the at-risk population language is contained in the bill, as opposed to being more definitive, is that the definition of prediabetes has only been developed in the last, say, year or two, and it's become more widely accepted. More than likely, my concern would be, and I'm speaking, this is not Novo Nordisk speak, this is me speaking as someone who's got a lot of experience in the diabetes public health space. Zeroing in on the pre-diabetes issue provides a lot less latitude to the agency, and my fear would be is that that would be a new reporting provision. Again, not an issue for Novo Nordisk, just an issue for the committee to consider. The broader language is what was adopted in Kentucky and also in Texas, as an example, and it provided the agencies with a fair amount of flexibility, and that ultimately is what got the agencies on board in those states. It's also the language that was supported by the Council of State Governments to provide the agencies and entities across the country with as much flexibility as possible.
Because I know that we're getting into areas where maybe the public certainly wouldn't want their information being gathered by the health authority if it was so broad to include at-risk populations.
The key in this is, number one, it's against federal law to collect any personally identifiable information. So that would trump anything that was being collected or reported in this bill, which is why we have a couple of amendments that we proposed earlier on to eliminate any concerns, and also what was, quite frankly, a little bit of a drafting issue in terms of a lot of back and forth with the drafting office. So there's nothing in here that's personally identifiable. It's looking more for just aggregate costs, aggregate estimates as to what's going on, not drilling down into what each person is doing, just trying to get a painting of how severe the issue is or not, and what's being done about it or not.
And because we're going through transformation, we're going to coordinated care organizations, we are going to be setting up a metric system, and they are going to be holding these CCOs accountable, and they are going to be developing their strategy on how to deliver health care to these at-risk populations with chronic disease. So I think there is a hesitancy to jump into something like this until we see how the metrics is going to develop for the CCOs. So there is some work that we need to do in the interim to figure out how this could be implemented, because it would mean a different set of metrics that the health authority would have to have in order to gather the information, which does take money. Yeah.
Okay.
One last thing, if I could add on the prediabetes versus populations that are at risk. The populations that's at risk language is pretty much what's included in the Medicare statute when it comes to screening for people with diabetes. So there would be consistency with what NCQA and other metrics-based organizations are collecting data on as well. So, but again, that's an issue for the committee to decide, not an issue for my company. That's just the background from having written that Medicare guidance about 10 years ago.
Great. Other questions for this panel? Thanks so much for bringing this forward. Appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Testimony. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1562 and open, are we on the last bill?
We are.
And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1568.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this establishes a requirement for health insurance coverage of autism spectrum disorders. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Excellent. And
we've got several people.
Excellent. Okay. Is there a certain order? Paul, do you want to come first?
And then we have a Dr. McCoy on the phone?
Yeah, I believe so.
And Dr. McCoy, are you there on the phone, Dr. McCoy?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm here.
And then
I'm going to go first, followed by Dr. McCoy, Melanie Shaw, and then Toby Rates.
Excellent. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you again about this bill in a public hearing. While we were obviously hoping for a good work session, we are certainly grateful for the opportunity to continue working on this and the dialogue and the support that we have had from so many people. As a reminder of what this bill does, as I mentioned on our last hearing, this bill reinforces and clarifies the existing laws requiring health benefit plans to cover diagnosis and treatment of autism spectrum disorders. I make the emphasis on the reinforce and clarify because we do already have...
Did you say the name for the record?
I apologize. Did I?
We need that.
Sorry. My name is Paul Turdall. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I am a father of two children with autism, and I have been working with the Autism Society, Portland Asperger's Network, and Autism Speaks on this bill. So, thank you. We have existing laws in Oregon that already require coverage for autism. That includes both the mental health parity law, for which autism is specifically in scope, as well as 743A190, children with pervasive developmental disabilities. As a practical matter, accessing care and coverage under those laws has been very challenging. Typically, most plans limit practical coverage to a small number, perhaps 20 hours of speech and occupational therapy per year, and make access to more intensive treatments, which are typically recommended by physicians, extremely difficult. What we have been finding is that when we have been pushing back hard through administrative processes or through litigation, it is possible for those who throw a great deal of energy and money into the process to get coverage under the laws that we have. Last year, you heard from Lisa McHenry, who, after several years and hundreds of thousands of dollars in expenses, won a court order to Pacific Source to cover those intensive treatments. A couple of weeks ago, I received an authorization form from Kaiser for applied behavior analysis treatment for one of my two boys. That came after 6 months of effort, a couple hundred hours of my time, about 50 hours of the insurance division's time, to basically work through the barriers until Kaiser basically acknowledged that they did not have a legal basis for denying that claim. So this coverage, again, under the laws that we already have, is entitling me to the core coverage that we're asking for in this bill. The real purpose of this bill is to streamline the process so people don't have to do 6 months of paperwork or go to court, and also to facilitate the type of best practice coverage that is now required by 29 other states through board certified behavior analysts who are experienced in autism treatment, and then supervised paraprofessionals who can carry out the hard work at a much lower cost. Currently, under that court order, Pacific Source is providing this kind of coverage through licensed mental health professionals at a rate of $96 per hour. This is very expensive and inefficient when you consider that could be at 20 to 25 hours a week, a cost of $120,000 per year per child that they are currently paying. Kaiser And I appreciate Kaiser for doing this after being confronted, you know, and basically directed by the insurance division that they needed to get on with covering my child, made a very sensible choice. And rather than sticking to the details of the contract, we, Kaiser and I agreed with the blessing of the insurance division to instead reimburse a board-certified behavior analyst and qualified paraprofessionals that she is supervising to carry out that care. What this bill does, in a sense, is puts a blessing on that structure, and it puts a regulatory structure under Department of Human Services to ensure that those providers have those credentials and qualifications. After our meeting, hearing last month, we did draft some Dash 1 amendments. And there were several things we addressed. You requested a fix for care by family members and household members. We have amended that, so those have been removed from the bill. Worked closely. We met with the Autism Commission and Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority regarding credentialing. And after some discussions, Department of Human Services has agreed to take that on. And so we have amended the bill to clarify. There were some vague areas where it sort of referred to an anonymous board or agency. We have clarified that to be Department of Human Services. And at DHS's request, we have given them authority to charge fees for registration.
Now, is this the DHS or the Oregon Health Authority?
OHA and DHS discussed it, and DHS, their conclusion was for DHS to do it.
Thank you.
There's precedent for that. There is an existing behavior consultant program, which is somewhat analogous to what we're doing. That DHS is managing, our criteria are stricter, but it is a comparable program DHS is doing. Further, the mental health parity law specifically makes reference to providers approved by DHS. It is also consistent with existing laws on the books. Right? There is wisdom for DHS. Other things we have done, after discussions with the Autism Commission, we added a clause basically ensuring that providers can continue to manage their own networks of providers, so that it wouldn't just be some any willing provider mandate where any insured could just pick anybody they wanted to, that providers were going to be able to go out and insurers were going to be able to go out and manage their networks, as indeed Kaiser is currently doing with my child by signing a contract with my BCBA. There were two other technical fixes. We removed the word intensive from behavioral health treatment just to clarify that not all behavioral health treatment is necessarily intensive. And a Scrivener's error, changing the name of one definition, but without any substantive content to it. We have been working on the content of this bill for several years. I personally have been working on it since the end of the 2009 session after House Bill 3000. We have worked on it through the Autism Commission, which I was appointed to the Insurance Committee. We have worked on it throughout last session when, through this committee, we had some facilitated discussions with the insurance industry. We have had a number of informal discussions over the last few months with professional associations in the insurance industry, which I believe greatly improved the quality and the content of the bill. And we also have had some good discussions with the insurance industry this week to further address those issues. So I am personally confident that we are really coming to something very good, and I do hope that in the very near future we can pass this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate your work on this.
So perhaps Dr. McCoy?
Yes, Dr. McCoy. This is Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and we have at the dais Senator Chip Shields, Senator Morse, and Senator Cruz. And you're talking to a room full of people very committed to this bill. Go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Robin McCoy. I'm a developmental behavior pediatrician at Oregon Health Science University. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm sorry I can't be there in person. I spent the last 12 years of my career with a focus on autism. Most recently, I've served as a lead autism specialist in the autism clinic at OHSU. I've also had the opportunity to serve on the health insurance subcommittee of the Oregon Autism Commission that Paul talked about. At OHSU, we diagnose around 150 children each year with autism and provide ongoing management services for another 100 to 150 children annually. In my time over the years, I've had the opportunity to witness the positive impact of autism-specific interventions, particularly when they're provided consistently to children shortly after they receive the diagnosis. Invariably, when I look back, those children that make the greatest progress are those children that receive intensive, empirically supported interventions on a consistent basis. There's been growing evidence in the last several years to suggest that a number of autism-specific intervention services, such as ABA, have empirical support. Unfortunately, in Oregon, such services aren't covered by insurance companies. Most insurance companies in Oregon provide very limited services for individuals with autism, and what they do cover, families frequently have to fight for. Almost on a weekly basis, families come to me for help with the appeal process to get services for their children. I ask you to picture yourselves in my shoes as I talk to the parents of a child who has recently been diagnosed with autism. Not only am I giving the parents their worst nightmare, the diagnosis of autism, I also have to tell them that there are treatments that will help their child, but in Oregon, their insurance company won't cover these services. Just last week, I had a family that was very motivated to get these services, and I actually recommended that they move out of the state of Oregon, as other states would offer them better services. This happens on almost a daily basis for me. It's time we did better in Oregon. I strongly support Senate Bill 1568. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to take any questions.
I'd like to just ask a couple of, it's been brought to my attention, I don't know if this is absolutely true, but there are more children born or develop autism in the state than in other places of the United States, and is there any research to show why this is so?
The biggest difference in Oregon and other states is that in Oregon, to get school services or early intervention services, you don't need a medical diagnosis of autism. So you are correct. If you look at our school system in Oregon, it's roughly, I want to say 1 in 70 or 1 in 77, I believe the most recent numbers are, have a school label of autism. However, I really honestly feel that some of those individuals would not meet criteria for a medical diagnosis. So if you look at the numbers that the CDC puts out, it's 1 in 110, and I truly believe that Oregon has similar numbers. We're just using different data.
Thank you. Other questions for Dr. McCoy? Thank you very much, and you're certainly welcome to stay on the line to listen to the rest of the testimony, but we'll understand if you do. Yes. Oh, Senator Morris. Well,
thank you. I do have a question, Dr. McCoy. The therapies that are used, what typical duration is there in achieving significant improvements? If you go through a behavior therapy, are they more than likely a lifetime change, or is it something that requires constant therapy?
So what research shows is that it's the intensive services early on, so at a young age. And typically, I strongly believe that if we can diagnose individuals with autism at the age of 2 or 3 and are able to give them intensive services from that age of 2 to 5, roughly, you know, not concrete, that these individuals are going to do better. And by the time they get into kindergarten, first grade, they're going to be able to transition to the public school and not need as much intensive services. And there has been some research that has shown that, you know, for every dollar we spend at this young age, we're saving, you know, roughly $50 as they get into adulthood. So it's not that they need intensive services throughout their lifetime. It's really that they need it when they're young. They need services as they get older, but the services are very different as you get to be older.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, thank you so much for hearing our testimony today. For the record, my name is Melanie Shaw, and I'm testifying today as a behavior analyst in the state of Oregon. Okay, I have great appreciation for the sponsors and supporters of this critical bill, and I thank you for hearing us today. I will be short and to the point. I am the owner and director of Play Connections Autism Services here in Beaverton, Oregon. We are a reputable group of 4 certified behavior analysts and 15 supervised paraprofessionals who provide effective and cost-effective applied behavior analysis services to now 30 young children with autism through our center as well as home-based programs. We collaborate regularly with speech-language pathologists, occupational therapists, psychologists, and developmental pediatricians. Our data systems strongly support our interventions in addressing behavior, language and communication, social engagement, cognition, motor, and self-help skills, resulting in life-changing outcomes for our clients. Roughly half of our clients receive 60 to 100% insurance coverage for APA.
How many?
At least half.
Half.
At least half of our services. So 15 plus out of our 30 clients do receive insurance coverage.
This coverage is, on that, do you bill directly then?
We bill directly for 2 of our cases right now.
And
but most of it is submitted directly by the parents, and they receive reimbursement.
I see.
Mm-hmm. These carriers do include Cigna, United Health, Anthem, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and now Kaiser. These carriers have grown to understand the profession of behavior analysis and the cost-effective medical need for our services. And this has been a great relief for the families who do have coverage, but it's also been a devastating blow to those without. We have witnessed heartbreaking scenarios of potentials lost because families simply cannot afford the therapy that they critically need. This discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots, depending on where one might work, is a social justice matter that I feel requires immediate attention. Please help close the gap by supporting Bill SB 1568. The children we serve rely on us to be their voice until we teach them to have their own. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and Senators. For the record, I'm Toby Rates, and I reside at 8144 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland, 97206. I'm here again in my capacity as the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon, as Treasurer for the Portland Asperger's Network, and as the mother of 2 children on the autism spectrum. The Autism Society of Oregon is the largest autism advocacy group in Oregon and the only one with a statewide presence. We represent everyone affected by autism across the state and throughout their lifespan. Our mission is to empower these individuals to improve the quality of their lives through support and information. We have volunteer chapter representatives in every region in Oregon, covering all 8 of the ESD regions. Statewide, over 4,700 people actively participate in the Autism Society of Oregon. As part of my duties, I speak every day with parents of newly diagnosed children. I'm here today to speak in support of SB 1568 and the -1 amendments. This bill will clarify and reinforce existing law to require that people on the autism spectrum have coverage through their insurance, the insurance that they're paying for autism therapies, and specifically medically necessary evidence-based autism therapies. These therapies, which include occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech-language therapy, and behavioral therapies, do not cure autism, but they help individuals on this autism spectrum to live more functional, productive, and meaningful lives, and to reduce their dependence on government support. In our view, we cannot have more delay in implementing this bill. We've already had years of conversations with all the stakeholders, and all of the stated objections to the bill have been heard and incorporated. There is, in my mind, clear consensus that the need for this bill is overwhelming. And the costs of delaying action to pass this bill are personal, emotional, and financial, with the consequences truly alarming. We currently have 8,000 school-aged children in Oregon who receive special ed services at a cost of $200 million per biennium to the state. Another 600 children are diagnosed every year. And I want to be clear, not all of these children need intensive autism therapies. that those who do need them and have access to them have their lives substantially and significantly improved by access to these therapies. If even half of the newly diagnosed children over the next year require intensive autism therapies, that's 300 additional children just this year who won't be getting the therapies that they need. And that's in addition to the several thousand who aren't getting them now. As an example of the results of timely medical interventions, I know of another a family here in Oregon that in another state had medical interventions for their now grown child, and that child has gone from being a service user to being an employed and productive adult who has now purchased her own health insurance. This influx of untreated children creates an enormous burden on our educational system. Not only does the school have to provide the therapies that should have been provided through the medical system, but they are dealing with children who have not received the early intervention that Dr. McCoy testified to as being so critical. In order for our children to benefit from medically necessary autism therapies, my husband and I have leveraged every asset we have. It hasn't made our children non-autistic, and it's not going to, but it's made an enormous difference in our child's ability to communicate and to access the world around him. Last year, we faced the prospect that those assets were essentially gone, and we would have to stop the therapies that were helping our son. It was devastating. But we were lucky that family members have helped us out, recognizing the importance of the therapies. But that's not a sustainable long-term solution. And we recognize that. And recognize that long-term, my sons will remain autistic. In contrast, I see children every day as severely impacted by autism as my son, but who don't have the resources to pay for private therapies. These children are unable to communicate with the world around them, and they're frustrated, angry, and out of control. Several are quite clearly headed for foster care, which will be devastating to them and their families. With treatment and therapy, these children could remain in loving homes, and instead they're looking at a lifelong cost to the state. Other parents I know have bankrupted themselves to provide autism therapies to their child. When there was equity in their homes, they mortgaged them. When the bottom dropped out of the housing market, homes were lost. Retirement accounts have been borrowed against and liquidated with large penalties. And certainly for most parents in this position, the idea of saving for retirement is long since passed. Even with health policies in effect, families are incurring bills in the thousands of dollars for things like speech therapy. Parents have had to make the decision to stay home to care for the enormous needs of our children, foregoing careers and family income. Some families have decided to stay home and homeschool their children because their children's needs can't be met in the public or private schools. The toll on our family lives is immense. The rate of divorce for parents of special needs children is 80%. And even in stable marriages, the effect on siblings is profound. We parents are placed in the position of having to pit the needs of a typically developing child against the needs of an autistic child. While every parent has to make compromises about what is best for one child versus another, the compromises that we face go to the heart of providing basic care and the possibility of a future for each of our children. Other families are moving out of Oregon, and these are families that would otherwise be productive, tax-paying citizens here in Oregon. They are the ones who have the wherewithal to find out where they will get insurance coverage and make the decision to leave because it's in the best interest of their child. In the long term, that's an enormous loss to this state. Under the current situations, parents now have the ability to pursue administrative remedies, a long, expensive, and time-consuming process. This is while they are also trying to raise an autistic child and deal with all the effects I just previously mentioned. I'm speaking for all the parents here and for those who couldn't be present today because of the demands of caring for their autistic child when I say that you cannot know the anguish of being told that your child has a lifelong disability and requires medical intervention, that these medical interventions exist and will help, but they're extremely expensive and insurance isn't going to cover it. Schools will help, but they don't have the funding to provide anywhere near what the medical experts agree your child needs. And so in most cases, the result of a very expensive medical diagnosis, often not covered by insurance, is, yep, he's autistic, good luck with that. Our children are challenging, and I have yet to meet the parent who expected an autistic child. But I've learned a lot from autism. I learned that you have to let go of the child you expected and love the child you were given. And I've also learned that love isn't enough. If I could hug my son normal, I would have by now, because he's really adorable. But I can't. He needs the help that trained therapists can provide to help him learn the things that come naturally to other children. Without that help, he's not functional. With that help, he's still autistic, but he has an infinitely better chance of living a functional, meaningful, and productive life. We are here today asking for help under the insurance policies we pay for in getting medically necessary, evidence-based therapies that will help our children learn how to navigate the world around them, a world that is utterly foreign and baffling to them. We don't want, and the state can't afford, to have people living as service users when, with appropriate therapies and supports, many could be contributing taxpaying citizens. I don't want to be a voice for people on the autism spectrum. I want them to have the tools that we know exist so that they can use their own voices or alternative communication devices. We are asking for the implementation of Senate Bill 1568 with the Dash 1 amendments to provide the medical treatments that our children need and should be covered under the insurance policies we pay for. Thank you for your time and for your consideration of SB 1568.
It means a lot for you, all of you, to come and testify. I do have one question, though. You said 50% had insurance, or 50% of those that you see have insurance that will cover it? And because with the Healthy Kids, we want every child should be able to have health insurance. Can you explain that?
Right, yes. Almost 100% of our clients have submitted claims to their insurance. Okay. Of course, so trying to gain access, about 50% have succeeded.
Okay.
Chair Morris Anderson, members of the committee, two things I wanted to add to that. One of the reasons her insurance payment rate is so high is that she's located near Intel, and Intel is one of those employers that has chosen to provide an autism benefit to all of its employees. So that's a major part of that. She also mentioned United Healthcare. There are some families who have United Healthcare policies in her clinic written in Texas, which does have an autism mandate, and so their employers are in Texas, they're based here, and they're getting that coverage. For a while last summer, United Healthcare was offering ABA coverage in its Oregon policies. I have spoken to them, and they are pulling back on that. I have also spoken to the insurance division. I think their method of pulling back is not legal, and I will be working with the insurance division to address that. Basically, they were adding a specific clause stating that they will cover would not cover specifically applied behavior analysis. And if you look at some point, Section 3 in the booklet I gave you, there's a court ruling from Washington State basically ordering a PEB in Washington State to cover ABA and striking out a similar policy on grounds of a violation of mental health parity. That was from last June.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't our health plan, PEB in Oregon, cover it?
PEB does not specifically exclude ABA. It does cover autism, and about 2 days ago, a friend of mine who used to be on PEB received a check from PEB for a couple thousand dollars worth of ABA treatment in 2011. That is the... So I think my sense is that PEB is currently obligated to pay for it, but may not be in the habit of doing it. And I think that is one of the things that we will be working on.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Morris.
Well, thank you. Does Oregon have a Mental Health Parity Act similar to the state of Washington?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I haven't read Washington's Mental Health Parity Act. I have read ours in detail. Ours is, I think, one of the most comprehensive in the country in terms of what it covers and how it covers it. I based on the McHenry decision from last year, what I have seen, I do believe that the same provision would also be illegal here. The other thing to keep in mind is the interaction between our mental health parity and the federal Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. Technically, that doesn't require anybody to cover any form of mental illness, but it does state that if you are covering anyone, then it must be on parity, and the restrictions in parity are very, very firm. Since our act specifically requires coverage of autism, that kicks in the Federal Mental Health Parity Act also, which has extremely strict terms for not merely dollar parity, but parity in terms of how forms of treatment are included or excluded from the policy. If you will excuse me, you raised a question about healthy kids, and I wanted to bring that up also. My understanding from discussions with Pacific Source, which is a Healthy Kids administrator, is that Healthy Kids follows the same rules as the Oregon Health Plan for what it covers. Autism is very explicitly covered under the Oregon Health Plan, but the coverage listed there is vague and not very strong. And we had a family that was on a Pacific Source Healthy Kids plan and had been told, oh, yes, we cover autism, but we don't cover any of the treatments that you want. And I'm very grateful to Pacific Source for stepping up and taking care of it and making sure that that child was treated. But because of the language of how that is put together, even the coverage that one would normally get through a private insurance plan for under Healthy Kids is extremely limited, and this is not something SB 1568 would address since it doesn't cover Oregon Health Plan, but it is something that we are very interested in working on through administrative processes and other means, and we will be doing that.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have caught just a little bit. I wasn't sure if you referenced what's been happening in California in your testimony. Could you explain how our Mental Health Parity Act compares to California and tell us what's been happening there?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Shields, thank you very much for bringing that up. California did also recently pass an autism bill very similar to the one that we have proposed. A couple of months ago, I had the opportunity to meet with the general counsel for the California's Department of Insurance, and they are taking a very, very aggressive stance on coverage of autism treatment under their Mental Health Parity Act. They have recently signed settlement agreements with three major insurers, basically requiring them to cover treatment under existing laws with either licensed provider or a supervised, board certified behavior analyst. The general counsel for the Department of Insurance told me that he was also intending to push all of the insurers that were covered in California to provide retroactive reimbursement for unpaid autism coverage to the date of implementation of mental health parity, whether the families had ever requested that coverage or not, whether they received it or not on grounds that it had been improperly denied as a matter of practice. He explained that he was not able to directly do that, but he was preparing to offer them such a large civil penalty that they would prefer to do so. That was what he told me. And so they are very aggressively working to do that. I should add, I personally have been getting coverage for my son as well as several other Kaiser families, largely by coordinating with similar activists in California who are on Kaiser plans there and basically learning from their techniques and applying those here. No, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call Rachel Green and Catherine Moore forward. Then we only have one more after you two. So we're at the same time. Okay.
Thank you. I'm Rachel Green, and I'm here speaking on behalf of my family, specifically my daughter, 4 years old with autism, severe enough that she is nonverbal, among other issues. And I apologize that I'm not very prepared. Such sometimes is the life of a parent with a child with autism. But in any case, the panel before us was very well spoken on this issue. I just want to reiterate what they said, as well as I am one of the have-nots that was mentioned. I was actually wanting to obtain a doctorate when I found out that my daughter has severe enough autism that I can't really pursue my own goals or goals for my family and be as productive in society as I would have liked. I have an older child who desperately needs my attention as much as she does, but in different ways, and I can't be more than one person. And yes, it has made me a single parent at times, and that's been even more interesting. I actually just moved here this last August, knowing that I would have to restart everything for her therapies, but not knowing what kind of situation I'd be confronting in that. Sorry, trying to get back to my list here, make sure I cover everything I wanted to say. The financial impact is both a burden on all the taxpayers, and I apologize because I didn't want it to be that way, but it's also such that we do not really get our needs met every month. I don't even know how we get through the month most of the time. Recently, it's been due to a lot of help from friends in the community, but my daughter needs therapies that she's not getting, and she's almost five. She did have therapies before, and they made a big difference. To address an earlier question that you asked, Senator Morse, you know, a lot of it does also depend on exactly where the individual falls on the spectrum, and it's so different that it's really hard to say. I mean, you can give a statistic, but she's still in the range where, you know, just having that drop-off in therapies, it's really having an impact, and I'm fighting everything I can to give her the tools that she needs still, but I'm just one person, and there's so many different issues that I have to take care of as a parent and just as a person that it's really hard to address everything by myself. So keeping that in mind. And the school system, I'm sure, are great, but it's not all that needs to be happening. So in any case, every moment counts, especially in the early childhood development of any child, especially one with autism, at least from what I could tell, as compared to my older child. Just making sure I get all this, sorry. I know that for my son, it would be really great to know his sister, not in just we're having another autism problem, or I have to make sure the other kids aren't making fun of her or making fun of me for having her as a sister because she does things that embarrass him and things like that. And he really needs my attention. But there are so many things that I want for Emily. I know that she really is very smart and that she could really... I know that there are things about her that could be unlocked, so to speak, if I only knew how to get to them. And not being professional, I don't. I can only go so far as to what I've already been told. But I'd like to keep pursuing that as soon as I can. And I wish I had the money, but I don't have any for the therapies that she needs. But for myself, I'm sure many of you have had children, you know, growing up and in your house, and maybe some of the conversations weren't so pleasant, but at least you got to have conversations. I wish I knew my daughter in a way that she could express to me her thoughts and feelings, as well as all the other skills that I hope she has one day. So that's why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. It really does.
Thanks.
Very powerful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just state that I'm simply here in support of the others, and they stated everything that I wanted to say. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We only have... Yes.
Can I just real quick?
Oh, absolutely. And then John Powell.
Thank you, Chair, members of the board. I saw a little confusion about the -6 amendments. I'm Shane Jackson, lobbyist for Autism Society of Oregon. So there's a little confusion of the -6. In the book that you got here, in the -1, sorry, -1, in the book that you got here, under Chapter 1, two pages in, you'll see an engrossed version of the bill with the red lines all in there. So if you need to look at the Dash 1 amendments, they're folded in right there.
Excellent. Thank
That's
you
everything.
So much. And did you say your name for the record?
I did. Shane Jackson,
okay,
Autism
all right.
Society.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much. Okay, John Powell.
Poor John. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair, just here today to talk to you about the procedure that Regents and some other insurers are going through currently with Mr. Trudell and others. We have been meeting, Pacific Source and Regents have been communicating with them during the interim. The reason the bags under my eyes are as big as they are is Paul starts his conference calls at 5 p.m. and some of my other clients want me up at 5 a.m. So there is absolutely solidarity, I think, on the part of insurers to find a way to provide coverage that the proponents of this bill seek. I think it's important to note that it is very difficult, and as Mr. Trudell pointed out to you, the bill has changed substantially due to our communications, and we appreciate that very, very much, and I think we're moving closer and closer to a good bill. It was mentioned that 26 other states have legislation. It's also fair to say that in almost all of those states, the bills have limitations inside of them. So we're right now searching legally to see what we can do with some of those. For example, Missouri has a $40,000 annual limitation on these services. And I'm not sure in Oregon we can have those kinds of caps. So we're searching those legally. We're in a series of meetings that now that Senator Bates and Senator Haas have called. We met yesterday. We'll meet again next Tuesday with Mr. Trudell and others. So we are making progress, and we're going to stick to the program of working with them.
I think it's important that I know Blue Cross Blue Shield, but it's important to have Kaiser at the table, Providence at the table, the independent insurers, and I see some of them in the room. But we would like to have, I would like to have input from all of them, so that if maybe just a few of you are meeting, then let's disseminate it to the rest, because I want a bill to pass out without having to go through what we have had to go through this time. So I would appreciate you being the spokesperson, and I thank you for coming forward with that.
They call me Short Straw for sure.
Oh, Short Straw, okay. All right, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You chose to step in the line of fire, though, John.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I do see about probably six or seven other lobbyists in the room. I'm a little frustrated, and hope you can help me understand what more the proponents could concede to get this bill to get through the process.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, that's a fair question. I think there are two primary areas right now, the credentialing of providers and how that works. And Mr. Trudell explained to you the variances in costs. At the same time, if we're not going to rely upon some kind of a licensure or qualifications that would lead to people being credentialed in some way, the insurers want to be able to credential providers. We owe it to our members if we authorize somebody to see a provider. We owe it to them to know that there are measures in effect that mean that this person meets certain criteria. So that's one.
Just to follow up on that, and I will do the analogy that, well, that, let's see, it was, is it?
Melanie,
yeah. She's the supervisor. It's sort of like what we do with in the school system, where we have the RN, and then we have, they train somebody to wash out the trach or do some other therapy. You're saying that you're not quite there in pain for someone who was under the supervision of a trained behavioral therapist or whatever.
Madam Chair, I think there are situations that of groups of therapists that have been presented to you that meet criteria that have been established, and then there will be those who wish to practice in this field who wouldn't necessarily be credentialed. And I think Mr. Tuttle had indicated that Kaiser had reached an agreement with someone who wasn't necessarily as trained as others to provide treatment at lower costs. And so those are issues we're talking about. And the other one is there any way to provide sideboards on the ultimate cost? The pediatrician from OHSU mentioned 150 children. If that average was $80,000 per year, that's $12 million just there. So we're looking at these costs that are going to be spread to other policyholders, and how every time those costs go up, somebody drops out of the system totally. So we're mindful of that and want to be good fiduciaries in terms of our responsibility to provide the best treatment at some kind of a cost that we can contain.
But why?
Go ahead, Madam.
But why couldn't we do something like a reinsurance, sort of like an OMIP pool? I mean, where there's a certain amount that everyone puts in a certain amount of money, and then when we do have these very few but still costly patients, that they could somehow be covered. Is the cost just so exorbitant that we wouldn't be able to do something like that?
Madam Chair and members, the OMIP pool has, I think, 12,000 members, and they spend about $90 million a year. And part of that is because there are high-cost people who did not have insurance prior to being diagnosed with something. And so their costs are double the average. And those are funded by an assessment that is spread out throughout insurers on every policy, every person covered. It's about $5 a month right now. This therapy could approach that or go beyond that. So just this one area. So we are trying to find ways. And as I said, in the other states that have passed these laws, there are sideboards in most cases.
Mm-hmm. It's just having known some that there's a point, you know, it's sort of like cancer treatment. Oh, we're only going to pay for the first 6 months, and then we're going to stop treatment, and you know, I mean, it's that mentality, and I wish that we could come up with some way of making sure that those who are truly benefiting from the therapy can get it. But I can understand why you say there needs to be sideboards, but it's very hard for me to accept that.
And Madam Chair, it's very hard to come up with something given the legal parameters that we face both with federal law and state law. And it, again, over time, I think we will develop some kind of a system that hopefully will lead to this applied behavioral analysis being applied to those that will benefit the most, and to those that might not benefit from it, some way of differentiating. These therapies, and as you know, autism, we don't know exactly what causes it, and we don't know exactly what helps the most, and it's changed over the years. And it will continue to change. And we, again, are working to try to find a methodology of how best to give those precious dollars, and they're just as precious to the people paying these premiums as it is to you to balance your budget in ways and means. We want to spend the dollars in the best possible way.
Well, we have an unsustainable healthcare system, and that's why we're going through healthcare transformation. We have to look at how we can be more efficient with our dollar, and I it's like a catch 22. So I hear what you're saying, and I hear that we cannot continue to have the health care costs skyrocket like they are not now, and I'm hoping that our CCO will truly show that we are going to save millions and millions and millions of dollars, so that then maybe some of that millions and millions and millions can be put into the children like the ones that are here today.
Yeah. I agree.
Yes, sure. Senator Shields.
Just in closing, I mean, I would really encourage you to continue to negotiate in good faith with the proponents. I think they are looking to make a deal, and I think the frustrations that I hear from people I've talked to is that they make a concession and then still not good enough. They make another concession and still not good enough, and we can't get there. And I think the mark of a good advocate is to not only work the position of their client, but also recommend to them what's in the best interest of the client and kind of bring them along. And I think that from some of the testimony I've been hearing, John, and again, this isn't, I have the utmost respect for you, this isn't directed at you personally, is that a number of the insurance companies are eventually accepting ABA treatment, but they're just making it as hard as hell to get it. Mm-hmm. And I think encouraging them to act in good faith is important, not only for this bill, but I think you all have advocated that the Attorney General shouldn't have the authority and the power to sue for fraud. And I think the best way to fight that off is to act in good faith in these kinds of matters. And I think also when you look at the insurance division, if they're not acting as aggressively as they are in California, that also helps make the case that maybe we need to tweak the Unfair Trade Practices Act. So anyway, I think I hope you all will just stay at the table and try to get this done, and we can all lock arms in 2013 and move on.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, we will be at the table, and that's fully our intention. And if you've noticed, I follow a young man around here, and his mother really wants him to have kids. So there is no reason that I don't want, as a human being, to have adequate health services available to everyone.
Thank you so much. I want to thank everyone here, especially the families. Your presence here is very important to us, as well as to the cause, as I'll call it. There are many legislators that are committed to bringing this back, and we have commitments from the insurers that, yes, we are going to come to terms, but no one can walk away from the table. I mean, yes, it won't be perfect. The proponents aren't going to be happy. The insurers aren't going to be happy. We have to blend something. That's just the way our democratic process works. So for both sides, that's extremely important. But again, thank you for coming. And colleagues, is Rebecca Land? I will close the public hearing on 1568, and is Rebecca Landis still here? Yes, Rebecca, I'd like to reopen a public hearing on 1567. She has a brief testimony she wants to make. Okay. And if you could please be quiet as you're leaving the room. Thank you, Dr. McCarr. I guess she's up. Please introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rebecca Landis, and I apologize for my procedural blunder in looking for the monitors instead of coming and signing it. I'm here to support passage of Senate Bill 1567 on behalf of the Oregon Farmers Markets Association, Corvallis Albany Farmers Markets, and the many direct marketing farmers who are key to revitalizing local food systems, stimulating grassroots economic development, improving food security, and providing healthy choices for Oregon families. I technically fit in that last category. My husband and I live on a small farm just south of Corvallis, just barely out of Senator Morris's district, but both of the markets I run are inside his district. We have an orchard and a little bit of produce as well. You heard numbers from other witnesses, and that wasn't my intent to do that anyway. I've been managing farmers markets for 17 market seasons, pretty much the whole time that these programs have existed. The Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program does not just bring direct participants to the markets and the farm stands. Seniors often bring one or two additional generations with them and thus share the experience of buying fresh fruits and vegetables directly from the farm that grew them. Seniors often have memories of older fruit and vegetable varieties that are not found in supermarkets. In my husband's stall, they fall into reverie upon seeing the bright red little snow apple that hangs on trees into winter. So why does that matter in terms of public policy? The answer is that seniors contribute to the resurgence of cooking and preserving whole foods rather than eating just highly processed foods from far away. When today's 20 and 30-somethings get interested in canning, most of them don't call mom. They hit the speed dial for grandma. Senior vouchers do bring revenue to farm direct marketers that we would otherwise not see in our market tills. And the $32 is meaningful to seniors if the number of calls that I field each year is any indication. But I like to look at this from a broader perspective. We want everyone in Oregon to have access to high-quality, nutritious foods that we grow here. The farm direct nutrition programs, along with increased access to Oregon Trail Card, SNAP, EBT, at farmers markets, helps us put the lie to the notion that healthy food is only for those with healthy bank account balances. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this bill, especially since I messed up procedurally.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's all important right. To hear from you.
All right. Thank you.
It. Yes, Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I just wonder, how many young adults today know how to can?
It's surprising, Senator Morse, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's surprising how many now. There's a certain resurgence among these younger people, and they're finding that they didn't grow up canning, and so that's why I say they leave mom out of that phone call. Grandma's the one to call. Of course, the extension service, I want to put in a plug for them. But I'm running into young people who know much, much more about this, and they're coming and buying. They're asking the farmers to buy in quantity so they can go home and preserve good foods. That would include drying as well as canning. But, yeah, 10 years ago, Senator Morse, we wouldn't be having that part of the conversation. It was a lost art, essentially.
I had suggested in the church that I attend in Albany, the Christian church close to the courthouse and close to the market, mm-hmm. We did a very significant remodeling, and we actually created a commercial kitchen.
Yes.
And I suggested that one of the outreach things that we might do would be to have open the kitchen and make it available for canning. And actually instructing and helping people that would bring their fresh produce and have a place to can their goods and provide the pressure cookers.
That's a great suggestion. Is it happening yet, or I would be happy to help facilitate that.
I would encourage you to give our pastor.
We have a relationship with a church. Our market actually uses the restrooms there, so I have a little bit of an in there, and also I have an in with the extension service. So, and that is a very great resource in Albany. So, I would like to work on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You.
Now, close the public hearing on 1567, and we're adjourned.